Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Lin Yang.
An estimated 500,000 kiloliters of gasoline were burned in the United States last year. But we'll hear about a new technology that could turn trash into fuel.
What we're doing is taking a that was originally headed for a landfill. Half of this material is going to be processed for the conversion of biofuel such as ethanol.
Meanwhile, some U.S. Navy scientists are working on a plan to turn seawater into fuel.
Well, it is a game changer potentially for the Navy or commercial entities because you can make fuel potentially where and when you need it.
We hear how computers and soybeans are being used to meet the challenge of feeding the world's growing population.
Hurricanes and cyclones can destroy whole communities, but we'll look at how weather forecasters try to predict storms.
How would rapid growth transform one U.S. city?
And some daring sailors will attempt to navigate the world in a Hawaiian canoe using only the stars.
That's all coming up on this Tuesday edition of Now.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration says that in 2013, the United States consumed more than 500,000 kiloliters of gasoline.
With regular gasoline averaging about $3.5 a gallon, that adds up to billions of dollars spent on fuel.
But what if you could make gasoline from trash?
VOA's Steve Barragona tells us about a project that turns corn cobs, wheat stalks, and even garbage into fuel.
A fresh load of garbage arrives at the Fiber-Aid Company's pilot plant in Southern Virginia. What begins as rotten vegetables, cardboard, and other trash becomes something much more valuable, says plant manager Randy Garrett.
What we're doing is taking a that was originally headed for a landfill. Half of this material is going to be processed for the conversion of biofuel such as ethanol.
Ethanol makes up about 10% of the U.S. fuel supply. Nearly all of it comes from corn, creating competition between food and fuel that critics say is raising food prices. But not at Fiber-Aid, where they load garbage into what is basically a giant pressure cooker.
That converts your paper, your cardboard, banana peels, any organic fibers, it converts it to a pulp. That pulp is what we're after for our energy fuel conversion.
The steaming pile of pulp that comes out of the cooker is mostly cellulose. Under the right conditions, cellulose can be turned into sugar, which can be turned into ethanol. This year, several other plants are expected to start making ethanol from the cellulose in corn stalks, wheat straw, and other plant matter. The shift has been a long time coming.
Someday you're going to be using this in your cars.
Back in 2007, President George W. Bush signed a law that required increasing amounts of ethanol in U.S. gasoline. One goal was to encourage new sources of fuel.
You develop new technologies that will enable you to make ethanol from wood chips or stalk grass or agricultural waste.
And energy created from plant matter would produce fewer greenhouse gases than petroleum fuels do. But making cellulosic ethanol turned out to be harder than expected, says University of Illinois agricultural economist Madhu Khanna.
You know, we know how to do that in a lab. It's the main problem is doing that in a continuous way, cost-effectively, on a large scale.
Cellulosic ethanol production has fallen far behind expectations while companies worked out the technical issues. This year could be the turning point. But Khanna says our cars may limit how much the industry can grow.
Even if we can begin to produce this, cost-effectively, we need to be able to consume it as well.
Only a few models of cars can handle high ethanol fuel. Without more of them on the road, there's only so much gas from garbage that will sell. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
If you would like to see video of this trash-to-fuel project, be sure to log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
And we welcome your comments on this story. Log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we're on Twitter. Our address there is at NowVOAShow.
While some scientists are working to make fuel from trash, U.S. Navy scientists are looking to the ocean for power.
Right now, they have managed to make a fuel that can power a model airplane.
But as VOA's George Puttage found out, these scientists are hoping to one day fuel much larger aircraft with only ocean water.
Natural gas and liquid fuels burned in all kinds of internal combustion engines are chemical compounds of hydrogen and carbon, coming mostly from underground reserves. But oceans are also huge reservoirs of hydrogen and increasingly carbon dioxide, or CO2. Dissolved in seawater from the air, it makes the water more acidic. Extracting those chemicals from the ocean and converting them into a form of liquid fuel was made possible by some recent technological advances, says U.S. Navy researcher Dr. Heather Willauer.
We've been actually able to show that we can recombine CO2 and hydrogen in the laboratory on a laboratory scale, into a liquid-type fuel.
The process requires a lot of electrical energy, which, to be economical, has to come from a cheap source, such as a nuclear power plant. Obviously, the most efficient place to do it would be aboard a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Willauer says these ships may someday manufacture their own jet fuel.
Well, it is a game changer, potentially for the Navy or commercial entities, because you can make fuel potentially where and when you need it.
The new fuel was successfully tested on a model airplane with a two-stroke engine. For now, making it requires twice as much power than the fuel can produce, but researchers hope to lower that ratio. Willauer says the new process will not increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which contributes to global warming.
Once we've pulled it out of seawater, the ocean is ready to pull it back in from the atmosphere because it's in constant equilibrium. So what we hope is it's a carbon neutral footprint.
Scientists hope a small-scale industrial plant may start converting seawater into fuel within the next 15 years. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
So what do you think? Let us know your thoughts by logging onto our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And if you would like to see video from this story, you can visit our webpage. That's www.voanews.com.
Do you like soybeans?
Do I like soybeans? I don't know.
I don't even know what it is.
Well, I mean, there are different things that they make out of soybeans. Like, you know, there's soy milk. There's, what is it, edamame. It's the
they're healthy, right?
The beans. They're healthy for you. There's also tofu. Now, do you eat tofu?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, well, that's bean curd.
It's from, yes.
It's made from soybeans, right?
Really?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so, actually. We have a lot of tofu-related products.
Really?
In our cuisine culture, Chinese cuisine.
Well, the other night I had a tofu penang. It was really good.
What is that?
Well, it's Thai food.
Okay.
It was very tasty, very spicy. Okay, well, you know that by the middle of this century, the world's population is expected to increase by 34%.
Then probably we need to grow a lot of potatoes for that.
Potatoes, soybeans, corn, whatever.
Exactly.
You know, feeding that exploding population is going to be a huge challenge. But Elizabeth Lee found out that a new study on our friend the soybean could help feed untold millions of people.
The UN predicts food production must increase by 70% to meet the needs of a wealthier and more urban world population. The World Food Prize Foundation president and former U.S. ambassador to Cambodia, Kenneth Quinn, calls it the greatest challenge in history.
There's going to be another 2 billion people on our planet between now and 2050. And how are we going to produce enough food for them to eat?
One solution is science. A new study led by Darren Drury of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is looking for a super soybean. A computer model can create a plant that can be more productive and reflects more light back into space to reduce global warming's effects while using less water. One plant with all these traits may be hard to find, but with data from real soybean plants, a computer can redesign a plant with the traits through the arrangement of the leaves, their density, and angle to the sun.
That's the real critical thing that we found here, that some of these goals that we might have intuitively thought were mutually exclusive, that we can't increase productivity without increasing water use, we find that there are changes to the architecture of modern soybean cultivars that can be made to help us improve on many of these goals.
The next step is to take the computer's model plant and test it in the field by artificial manipulation, says University of Illinois Professor Stephen Long, speaking via Skype.
One of the things the modeling has predicted is that there's too much leaf area. So we're actually removing leaves as the plant's growing to get a lower leaf area. We're also artificially modifying the angle of the leaves as well to reflect what the model predicted.
If the plants in the field behave as predicted, scientists will look for soybean lines with specific traits and crossbreed them into the computer's super soybean. Long says it is important to find solutions to the predicted global food shortage before it happens, because even if the super soybean can become reality, it will be another 20 years before the crop can appear in a farmer's field. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
So what about you? Are soybeans a part of your diet?
You can let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
We might read your comments on a future show.
Tomorrow way too far away. We can't get back yesterday. But we young right now. We got right now. So get up right now. 'Cause all we got is right now.
It's been nearly 9 years since Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans and the Gulf Coast of the United States.
And residents along the U.S. East Coast are still rebuilding from the damage of Superstorm Sandy 2 years ago.
This year, U.S. officials are predicting 11 named storms, including five hurricanes, two of which are expected to reach major status with winds higher than 163 kilometers per hour.
VOA's Roseanne Skirbo tells us now how meteorologists work to predict dangerous weather and warn people in the path of deadly storms.
Tom Boyd sits before a bank of computers that streams live data from weather satellites.
As we speak, we're looking at what is happening on the satellite. This schedule is actually happening on a satellite. It tells the imager and sounder when to start and stop and where to scan at over the U.S.
The imager works like a camera in space, and the sounder measures the temperature radiated from clouds, oceans, and air. Boyd is among the dozens of aerospace engineering technicians in the control room who gather that data and make sure the satellites run properly around the clock.
Earlier, we had a special event on this particular satellite. We just kind of brought it out of semi-storage and just started up the schedule. So we're expecting to see a few limits flag out until the thing settles down to satellite, probably over the next 24-hour period.
NOAA's fleet includes 16 satellites. Some remain in a set position over the United States. Others constantly circle the globe. The challenge is to get as accurate a picture of the atmosphere as possible, says Mike Condre, deputy director of NOAA's Office of Satellite Operations.
They give you the temperature, the winds, the humidity, the kind of information, and that is data is put into the computer models that the National Weather Service runs, and those computer models are what give people the long-term forecasts, 3 days, 5 days, 7 day forecasts to prepare.
And those long-term forecasts can save lives.
Every time we see a hurricane, every time we see any kind of severe weather out there, that underscores the importance to the folks out here on the floor of what they do every day.
Condre expects predictions to get even better with the launch of the Joint Polar Satellite System in early 2017.
What these will provide is about an order of magnitude, in other words, about 10 times more volume of data on the atmospheric state of the winds, the temperature, and the humidity in the atmosphere.
That information will improve the day-to-day forecast. Seasonal forecasts rely on even more data sources. In addition to satellites, they depend on ocean buoys that record sea temperatures and observations from ships. NOAA and Colorado State University issue annual hurricane reports to let planners and the public know what to expect. Warmer than normal waters in the tropical Pacific generally indicate fewer storms in the Atlantic. CSU research scientist Philip Klotzbach mines the tropical Atlantic for similar clues. He spoke via Skype.
If the waters are warmer than normal, that tends to mean there's more fuel for the developing storms. If the atmospheric pressures are lower than normal, that tends to mean the atmosphere is more unstable and more conducive for storms to form and to intensify.
But errors do occur. An active Atlantic hurricane season was predicted last year. That didn't happen.
It is certainly very difficult to predict and is very complicated because the atmosphere and the ocean interact in a very complicated manner, and you have to take into account a lot of these complicated relationships when you're issuing these seasonal predictions.
But Klotzbach says mistakes better inform the next forecast, adding prediction remains an inexact science. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of Roseanne's story about how meteorologists are trying to predict these kind of storms, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
Or leave us a line on our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Wait till you're announced. We've not yet lost all our graces. The hounds will stay in chains. Look upon your greatness as you'll send the call out, send the call out, send the call out, send the call out, send.
The latest U.S. Census figures show that cities are the fastest-growing regions in the country.
But how can urban areas meet the challenges of growing population?
VOA's Greg Flake has visited Houston, Texas, and tells us how one of the nation's fastest-growing metropolitan areas plans to handle its increased number of residents.
Traffic congestion is viewed as the biggest problem in the Houston metropolitan area, according to the survey. Houston has one light rail line and a bus system that city officials admit is inadequate. So most people drive to work from far-off suburbs.
But younger people increasingly are looking for a more urban lifestyle.
People like Navrit want more investment in public transportation.
At least around town, like maybe within the loop or so, because a lot of the young professionals live within this area, so I think that's feasible.
But many suburban commuters want the money spent on road improvements instead. The director of the Houston survey, Rice University's Steven Kleinberg, says despite this split, Houston is adjusting.
What's so interesting is to watch Houston reinventing itself, beginning to provide and build some of those walkable areas as it responds to a public that is 50% divided between wanting more cars and suburbs and wanting more walkable urbanism.
Houston has also seen a huge demographic shift. Kleinberg says this happened as job opportunities drew people from other parts of the United States and other parts of the world.
It's been fascinating to watch a city that has been at the forefront of the demographic and economic transformations of America.
The latest census figures show the fastest growth across the nation is taking place in urban areas like Houston. Kleinberg says the Houston survey's 33 years of data provides a moving picture of a rapidly changing urban area and a glimpse of where this city and the rest of the country are headed. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
What about you? Do you live in a growing city? How does your city plan to face the future?
You can let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our address there is at Now VOA Show.
In one ancient Hawaiian legend, the Polynesian navigator Hawaiʻiloa sailed from the Marquesas Islands to discover Hawaii.
According to this legend, Hawaiʻiloa sailed some 3,900 kilometers of open water in a canoe and landed on what is now Hawaii.
Whether you believe the legend or not, some modern sailors are hoping to top Hawaiʻiloa's feat by sailing around the world in a couple of open canoes.
As Heidi Chen tells us, these sailors plan to use only the stars to navigate to raise awareness of how to care for the planet.
Okay, hold up on the bow. Let me get the stern out some more.
When the Hawaiian voyaging canoe, known as Hokulea, first sailed from Hawaii to Tahiti in 1976, No one imagined it would spark a revival of Polynesian voyaging throughout the Pacific and become an important symbol of cultural pride.
Our primary motivation in building and sailing and navigating canoes was to have Hawaiians and other Polynesians and other Pacific Islanders take over the leadership in relearning, reinventing the technology, and in putting it to use and demonstrating its use. So it becomes their project, not my project.
Ben Finney is the founding president of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, which built the canoe. Now 82, the retired anthropologist says they initially wanted to demonstrate it was possible for Polynesians to have intentionally explored and settled the Pacific. Finney recalls they also wanted to revive the art of wayfinding, navigating without instruments, guided only by the stars, winds, waves, birds, and other signs of nature. The tradition had been lost in Polynesia. Fortunately, the society found an expert navigator in Micronesia, and under his guidance, Nainoa Thompson became the first Hawaiian in 600 years to practice the art of wayfinding. Thompson also integrated the tradition with modern science. Since then, he's helped train a whole new generation of navigators.
Hold this line, girls. You guys got to pull a sweep over towards you guys, to this railing, yeah?
Now, after nearly 40 years of sailing Hokulea around the Pacific and the Pacific Rim, Thompson is about to embark on a worldwide voyage called Malama Honua, caring for our Earth. He says several people inspired the vision for the voyage, including his friend, the late NASA astronaut, Lacey Veach.
And he kept saying, I know you need to know how beautiful your island Earth is. It's just one island in space. It's all we got. There's no other island that we can go to. And it's fragile, and it needs to be protected, and Hokulea needs to help us learn and find the way, take it around the world. That was 22 years ago.
To prepare for the expedition, Thompson and his crew spent a year sailing around the Hawaiian Islands with Hokulea, which means Star of Gladness, and a new canoe, Hikianalia. Both are named after stars that navigators use to guide them back to Hawaii. The double-hulled canoes will circumnavigate the globe together. The voyagers will visit more than 20 countries, learning from other cultures.
Imagine that we're going to go to South Africa, and imagine that Archbishop Desmond Tutu, if he's healthy, will invite us into his country. And imagine that we're going to have the chance to meet the Zulu that are about 140,000 to 180,000 years old. And to celebrate the fact that they're still here on this planet, maybe one of the oldest cultures. So it's our privilege to be able to meet the youngest culture, have the ability to explore and go and meet and pay respect to all the cultures on the Earth.
One goal of the worldwide voyage is to inspire young people and strengthen a new generation of navigators and voyagers. That's why half the crew is under the age of 30. Thompson, who's now in his 60s, hopes many people will follow the voyage online at hokulea.com and participate in its educational journey.
Because if you don't teach children how to take care of the world, they won't have the tools to do that. So we're not going to go save the world, us guys. All we're trying to do with Hokulea and Hikianalia is do our part, and our part is to sail. And so we want to join that human movement of kindness and compassion on the planet with the belief that collectively we can make a difference.
Once the canoes leave Hawaii with the first good wind, they won't return until 2017. Nainoa Thompson will captain and navigate Hokulea on the first leg of the voyage to Tahiti, sharing a message of aloha and malama honua. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
So what about you? Would you venture out with only the stars to guide you?
What's your greatest adventure? Let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can send us an email by addressing it to voaasia@voanews.com.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Now.
If you want to hear any of our stories again, log on to our website, www.voanews.com/now.
That's also where you can download the podcast, and we're also on iTunes.
If you have any questions or comments, log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Our address there is @NowVOAShow.
And you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
Patrice Martin produces our show.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Join us again tomorrow for another edition of Now. Until then, I'm David Berg.
And I'm Lin Yang.
Thanks for listening.